He was Shin. The Pashend who took responsibility for sending him, Sadius said.
Yes, Elokar replied. And yet they are savages and easily manipulated. It would be a perfect distraction, pinning the blame on a group of Pashmen. We go to war for years and years, never noticing the real villains, working quietly in my own camp. They watch me. Always. Waiting. I see their faces in mirrors. Symbols. Twisted. Inhuman.
Dalinar glanced at Sadius, and the two shared a disturbed look. Was Elokar's paranoia growing worse, or had it always been hidden? He saw phantom cabals in every shadow, and now, with the attempt on his life, he had proof to feed those worries.
Retreating from the shattered plains could be a good idea, Dalinar said carefully. But not if it is to begin another war with someone else. We must stabilize and unify our people.
Elokar sighed.
Chasing the assassin only an idle thought right now? Perhaps we won't need it. I hear that your efforts with Sadius have been fruitful.
They have indeed, your majesty, Sadius said, sounding proud, perhaps a little smug. Though Dalinar still insists on using his own slow bridges, sometimes my forces are nearly wiped out before he arrives. This would work better if Dalinar would use modern bridge tactics.
The waste of life, Dalinar said.
Is acceptable, Sadius said. They're mostly slaves, Dalinar. It's an honor for them to have a chance to participate in some small way.
I doubt they see it in that light.
I wish you'd at least try my way, Sadius continued. What we've been doing so far has worked, but I worry that the Pashendi will continue to send two armies against us. I don't relish the idea of fighting both on my own before you arrive.
Dalinar hesitated. That would be a problem. But to give up the siege bridges?
Well, why not a compromise? Elokar said. Next plateau assault, Uncle. You let Sadius's bridgemen help you for the initial march to the contested plateau. Sadius has plenty of extra bridge crews he could lend you. He could still rush on ahead with a smaller army, but you'd follow more quickly than you have been, using his bridge crews.
That would be the same as using my own bridge crews, Dalinar said.
Not necessarily, Elokar said. You've said that the Pashendi can rarely set up and fire on you once Sadius engages them. Sadius's men can start the assault as usual, and you can join once he's secured a foothold for you.
Yes, Sadius said, thoughtful. The bridgemen you use will be safe, and you won't be costing any additional lives, but you'll arrive at the plateau to help me twice as quickly.
What if you can't distract the Pashendi well enough? Dalinar asked. What if they still set up archers to fire on my bridgemen when I cross?
Then we'll retreat, Sadius said with a sigh. And we'll call it a failed experiment. But at least we'll have tried. This is how you get ahead, old friend. You try new things.
Dalinar scratched his chin in thought.
Oh, go on, Dalinar, Elokar said. He took your suggestion to attack together. Try it once his way.
Very well, Dalinar said. We will see how it works.
Excellent, Elokar said, standing. And now I believe I'll go congratulate your son. That bout was exciting.
Dalinar hadn't found it particularly exciting. Adolin's opponent hadn't ever held the upper hand. But that was the best kind of battle. Dalinar didn't buy the arguments about a good fight being a close one. When you won, it was always better to win quickly and with extreme advantage. Dalinar and Sadius stood in respect as the king descended the stair-like stone outcroppings toward the sandy floor below. Dalinar then turned to Sadius.
I should be leaving. Send me a clerk to detail the plateaus you feel we could try this maneuver on. Next time one of them is up for assault, I'll march my army to your staging area and we'll leave together. You and the smaller, quicker group can go on ahead, and we'll catch up once you're in position.
Sadius nodded. Dalinar turned to climb up the steps toward the ramp out.
Dalinar, Sadeus called after him.
Dalinar looked back at the other High Prince. Sadeus's scarf fluttered in a gust of wind, his arms folded, the metallic golden embroidery glistening.
Send me one of your clerks as well, with a copy of that book of Gavilar's. It may amuse me to hear its other stories.
Dalinar smiled.
I will do so, Sadeus.
An honor.
Above the final void I hang, friends behind, friends before. The feast I must drink clings to their faces, and the words I must speak spark in my mind. The old oaths will be spoken anew.
Dated Beta Bannon, 1173. 45 seconds pre-death. Subject, a light-eyed child of 5 years. Diction improved remarkably when giving sample. Kaladin glared at the three glowing topaz spheres on the ground in front of him. The barrack was dark, empty save for Teft and himself. Lopin leaned in the sunlit doorway, watching with a casual air. Outside, Rock called out commands to the other bridgemen. Kaladin had them working on battle formations. Nothing overt. It would be construed as practice for bridge carrying, but he was actually training them to obey orders and rearrange themselves efficiently. The three little spheres, only chips, lit the stone ground around themselves in little tan rings. Kaladin focused on them, holding his breath, willing the light into him. Nothing happened. He tried harder, staring into their depths. Nothing happened. He picked one up, cupping it in his palm, raising it so that he could see the light and nothing else. He could pick out the details of the storm, the shifting, spinning vortex of light. He commanded it, willed it, begged it. Nothing happened. He groaned, lying back on the rock, staring at the ceiling.
"Maybe you don't want it badly enough," Teft said.
"I want it as badly as I know how. It won't budge, Teft."
Teft grunted and picked up one of the spheres.
"Maybe we're wrong about me," Kaladin said. It seemed poetically appropriate that the moment he accepted this strange, frightening part of himself, he couldn't make it work.
"It could have been a trick of the sunlight."
"A trick of the sunlight," Teft said flatly. "Sticking a bag to the barrel was a trick of the light."
"All right. Then maybe it was some odd fluke. Something that happened just that once."
"And when you were wounded," Teft said, "and whenever on a bridge run you needed an extra burst of strength or endurance."
Kaladin let out a frustrated sigh and tapped his head back lightly against the rock floor a few times.
"Well, if I'm one of these radiants you keep talking about, why can't I do anything?"
"I figure," the grizzled old bridgeman said, rolling the sphere in his fingers, "that you're like a baby, making his legs work. At first it just kind of happens. Slowly he figures how to make them move on purpose. You just need practice."
"I've spent a week staring at spheres, Teft. How much practice can it take?"
"Well, more than you've had, obviously."
Kaladin rolled his eyes and sat back up.
"Why am I listening to you? You've admitted that you don't know any more than I do."
"I don't know anything about using the stormlight," Teft said, scowling. "But I know what should happen."
"According to stories that contradict one another, you've told me that the Radiants could fly and walk on walls."
Teft nodded.
"They sure could. And make stone melt by looking at it. And move great distances in a single heartbeat. And command the sunlight. And..."
"And why," Kaladin said, "would they need to both walk on walls and fly? If they can fly, why would they bother running up walls?"
Teft said nothing.
"And why bother with either one," Kaladin added, "if they can just move great distances in a heartbeat?"
"I'm not sure," Teft admitted.
"We can't trust the stories or legends," Kaladin said.
He glanced at Syl, who had landed beside one of the spheres, staring at it with childlike interest.
Who knows what is true and what has been fabricated? The only thing we know for certain is this.
He plucked up one of the spheres and held it up in two fingers. The Radiant sitting in this room is very, very tired of the color brown. Teft grunted.
You're not a Radiant, lad. Weren't we just talking about— Oh, you can infuse, Teft said. You can drink in the stormlight and command it. But being a Radiant was more than that. It was their way of life. The things they did. The immortal words.
The what? Teft rolled his sphere between his fingers again, holding it up and staring into its depths.
Life before death. Strength before weakness. Journey before destination. That was their motto, and was the first ideal of the immortal words. There were four others.
Kaladin raised an eyebrow.
Which were? I don't actually know, Teft said. But the immortal words, these ideals, guided everything they did. The four later ideals were said to be different for every order of Radiance. But the first ideal was the same for each of the ten. Life before death, strength before weakness, journey before destination.
He hesitated.
Or so I was told.
Yes, well, that seems a little obvious to me, Kaladin said. Life comes before death, just like day comes before night. Or one comes before two. Obvious.
You're not taking this seriously. Maybe that's why the Stormlight refuses you.
Kaladin stood and stretched.
I'm sorry, Teft. I'm just tired.
Life before death, Teft said, wagging a finger at Kaladin. The Radiant seeks to defend life. Always. He never kills unnecessarily. And never risks his own life for frivolous reasons. Living is harder than dying. The Radiant's duty is to live. Strength before weakness. All men are weak at some time in their lives. The Radiant protects those who are weak, and uses his strength for others. Strength does not make one capable of rule. It makes one capable of service.
Teft picked up the spheres, putting them in his pouch. He held the last one for a second, then tucked it away too.
Journey before destination. There are always several ways to achieve a goal. Failure is preferable to winning through unjust means. Protecting 10 innocents is not worth killing one. In the end, all men die. How you lived will be far more important to the Almighty than what you accomplished.
The Almighty? So the knights were tied to religion?
Isn't everything? There was some old king who came up with all this. Had his wife write it in a book or something. My mother read it. The Radiance based the ideals on what was written there.
Kaladin shrugged, moving over to begin sorting through the pile of Bridgman's leather vests. Ostensibly, he and Teft were here checking those over for tears or broken straps. After a few moments, Teft joined him. "Do you actually believe that?" Kaladin asked, lifting up a vest, tugging on its straps. "That anyone would follow those vows? Particularly a bunch of light eyes?"
"They weren't just light eyes. They were Radiants.
They were people," Kaladin said. "Men in power always pretend things like virtue or divine guidance— some kind of mandate to protect the rest of us. If we believe that the Almighty put them where they are, it's easier for us to swallow what they do to us." Teft turned a vest over. It was beginning to tear beneath the left shoulder pad.
"I never used to believe. And then I saw you infusing light and I began to wonder."
"Stories and legends, Teft," Kaladin said. "We want to believe that there were better men once. That makes us think it could be that way again. But people don't change. They are corrupt now. They were corrupt then.
Maybe, Teft said. My parents believed in all of it. The immortal words, the ideals, the Knights Radiant, the Almighty. Even old Voronism. In fact, especially old Voronism.
That led to the hierocracy. The devotaries and the Ardents shouldn't hold land or property. It's too dangerous. Teft snorted.
Why? You think they'd be worse at being in charge than the Light Eyes?
Well, you've probably got a point there. Kaladin frowned. He'd spent so long assuming the Almighty had abandoned him, or even cursed him, that it was difficult to accept that maybe, as Syl had said, he'd instead been blessed. Yes, he'd been preserved, and he supposed he should be grateful for that. But what could be worse than being granted great power, yet still being too weak to save those he loved? Further speculation was interrupted as Lopin stood up straight in the doorway, gesturing covertly to Kaladin and Teft. Fortunately, there wasn't anything to hide anymore. In fact, there hadn't ever been anything to hide, other than Kaladin sitting on the floor and staring at the spheres like an idiot. He set aside the vest and walked to the entrance. Hashal's palanquin was being carried directly toward Kaladin's barrack, her tall, oft-silent husband walking alongside. The sash at his neck was violet, as was the embroidery on the cuffs of his short, vest-like jacket. Gaz still hadn't reappeared. It had been a week now, and no sign of him. Hashal and her husband, along with their light-eyed attendants, did what he'd once done, and they rebuffed any questions about the bridge sergeant.
"Storm it," Teft said, stepping up beside Kaladin. "Those two make my skin itch. Same way it does when I know someone's got a knife and is standing behind me."
Rock had the bridgemen lined up and waiting quietly as if for inspection. Kaladin walked out to join them, Teft and Lopin following behind. The bearers set the palanquin down in front of Kaladin. Open-sided with only a small canopy on the top, it was little more than an armchair on a platform. Many of the light-eyed women used them in the war camps. Kaladin reluctantly gave Hashal a proper bow, prompting the other bridgemen to do so as well. Now was not the time to be beaten for insubordination.
"You have such a well-trained band, bridge leader," she said, idly scratching her cheek with a ruby-red nail, her elbow on her armrest. "So efficient at bridge runs."
"Thank you, Brightness Hashal," Kaladin said, trying, but failing, to keep the stiffness and hostility from his voice. "May I ask, Gaz hasn't been seen for some days now. Is he well?"
"No."
Kaladin waited for further reply, but she didn't give one.
"My husband has made a decision. Your men are so good at bridge runs that you are a model to the other crews. As such, you will be on bridge duty every day from now on."
Kaladin felt a chill. "And scavenging duty?"
"Oh, there will still be time for that. You need to take torches down anyway, and plateau runs never happen at night. So your men will sleep during the day, always on call, and will work the chasms at night. A much better use of your time."
"Every bridge run," Kaladin said. "You're going to make us go on every one?"
"Yes,"
she said idly, tapping for her bearers to raise her.
"Your team is just too good. It must be used. You'll start full-time bridge duty tomorrow. Consider it an honor."
Kaladin inhaled sharply to keep himself from saying what he thought of her honor. He couldn't bring himself to bow as she retreated, but she didn't seem to care. Rock and the men started muttering. Every bridge run. She'd just doubled the rate at which they'd be killed. Kaladin's team wouldn't last another few weeks. They were already so low on members that losing one or two men on an assault would cause them to flounder. The Parshendi would focus on them then, cutting them down.
"Kallax breath," Teft said. "She'll see us dead."
"It's not fair," Lopin added.
"We're bridgemen," Kaladin said, looking at them. "What made you think that any kind of fairness
applied to us.
She hasn't killed us fast enough for Sadius, Moash said. You know that soldiers have been beaten for coming to look for you, to see the man who survived the high storm? He hasn't forgotten about you, Kaladin.
Teft was still swearing. He pulled Kaladin aside, Lopin following, but the others remained talking among themselves.
Damnation, Teft said softly. They like to pretend to be even-handed with the bridge crews. Makes them seem fair. Looks like they gave up on that. Bastards.
What do we do, Goncho? Lopin asked.
We go to the chasms, Kaladin said. Just like we're scheduled to.
Then we make sure we get some extra sleep tonight, as we're apparently going to be staying up all night tomorrow.
The men will hate going into the chasms at night, lad, Teft said.
I know.
But we're not ready for what we need to do, Teft said, looking to make sure nobody could hear.
It was only him, Kaladin, and Lopin.
It will be another few weeks, at least.
I know.
We won't last another few weeks, Teft said. With Sadius and Colin working together, runs happen nearly every day. Just one bad run, one time with the Parshendi drawing bead on us, and it will all be over. We'll be wiped out.
I know, Kaladin said, frustrated, taking a deep breath and forming fists to keep himself from exploding.
Goncho, Lopin said.
What? Kaladin snapped.
It's happening again.
Kaladin froze, then looked down at his arms. Sure enough, he caught a hint of luminescent smoke rising from his skin. It was extremely faint. He didn't have many gemstones near him, but it was there. The wisps faded quickly. Hopefully the other bridgemen hadn't seen.
Damnation. What did I do?
I don't know, Teft said. Is it because you were angry at Hashal?
I was angry before.
You breathed it in, Syl said eagerly, whipping around him in the air a ribbon of light.
What?
I saw it. She twisted herself around. You were mad. You drew in a breath, and the light? It came too.
Kaladin glanced at Teft, but of course the older bridgeman hadn't heard.
Gather the men, Kaladin said. We're going down to our chasm duty.
And what about what has happened? Teft said. Kaladin, we can't go on that many bridge runs. We'll be cut to pieces.
I'm doing something about it today. Gather the men. Syl, I need something from you.
What?
She landed in front of him and formed into a young woman. Go find us a place where some Parshendi corpses have fallen.
I thought you were going to do spear practice today.
That's what the men will be doing, Kaladin said.
I'll get them organized first. After that, I have a different task.
Kaladin clapped a quick signal and the bridgemen made a decent arrowhead formation. They carried the spears they'd stashed in the chasm, secured in a large sack filled with stones and stuck in a crevice. He clapped his hands again and they rearranged into a double-line wall formation. He clapped again and they formed into a ring with one man standing behind every two as a quick step in reserve. The walls of the chasm dripped with water, and the bridgemen splashed through puddles. They were good. Better than they had any right to be. Better, for their level of training, than any team he'd worked with. But Teft was right. They still wouldn't last long in a fight. A few more weeks and he'd have them practiced enough with thrusts and shielding one another that they'd begin to be dangerous. Until then, they were just bridgemen who could move in fancy patterns. They needed more time. Kaladin had to buy them some.
Teft, Kaladin said, take over.
The older bridgeman gave one of those cross-armed salutes.
Syl, Kaladin said to the Spren, let's go see those bodies.
They're close. Come on.
She zipped off down the chasm, a glowing ribbon. Kaladin started after her.
Sir,
Teft called. Kaladin hesitated. When had Teft started calling him Sir? Odd how right that felt.
Yes?
You want an escort?
Teft stood at the head of the gathered bridgemen, who were looking more and more like soldiers, with their leather vests and spears held in practiced grips. Kaladin shook his head.
I'll be fine.
Chasm fiends.
The Light Eyes have killed any who prowl this close to our side. Besides, if I did run into one, what difference would two or three extra men make?
Teft grimaced behind his short, graying beard, but offered no further objection. Kaladin continued to follow Syl. In his pouch, he carried the rest of the spheres they'd discovered on bodies while scavenging. They made a habit of keeping some of each discovery and sticking them to bridges, and with Syl helping at scavenging, they now found more than they used to. He had a small fortune in his pouch. That stormlight, he hoped, would serve him well today. He got out a sapphire mark for light, avoiding pools of water floating with bones. A skull bobbed leisurely in one, wavy green moss growing across the scalp like hair, lifespren bobbing above. Perhaps it should have felt eerie to walk through these darkened slots alone, but they didn't bother Kaladin. This was a sacred place, the sarcophagus of the lowly, the burial cavern of bridgemen and spearmen who died upon light-eyed edicts, spilling blood down the sides of these ragged walls. This place wasn't eerie, it was holy. He was actually glad to be alone with his silence and the bobbing remains of those who had died. These men hadn't cared about the squabbles of those born with lighter eyes than they. These men had cared about their families, or, at the very least, their sphere pouches. How many of them were trapped in this foreign land? These endless plateaus, too poor to escape back to Alethkar. Hundreds died each week, winning gems for men who were already rich, winning vengeance for a king long dead. Kaladin passed another skull, missing its lower jaw, the crown split by an axe's blow. The bones seemed to watch him, curious, the blue stormlight in his hand giving a haunted cast to the uneven ground and walls. The devotaries taught that when men died, the most valiant among them, the ones who fulfilled their callings best, would rise to help reclaim heaven. Each man would do as he had done in life. Spearmen to fight, farmers to work spiritual farms, light eyes to lead. The Ardens were careful to point out that excellence in any calling would bring power. A farmer would be able to wave his hand and create great fields of spiritual crops. A spearman would be a great warrior, able to cause thunder with his shield and lightning with his spear. But what of the bridgemen? Would the Almighty demand that all of these fallen rise and continue their drudgery? Would Dunny and the others run bridges in the afterlife? No Ardens came to them to test their abilities or grant them elevations. Perhaps the bridgemen wouldn't be needed in the war for heaven. Only the very most skilled went there anyway. Others would simply slumber until the Tranquiline Halls were reclaimed.
So do I believe again now?
He climbed over a boulder wedged in the chasm.
Just like that?
He wasn't sure, but it didn't matter. He would do the best he could for his bridgemen. If there was a calling in that, so be it. Of course, if he did escape with his team, Sadius would replace them with others who would die in their stead.
I have to worry about what I can do, he told himself. Those other bridgemen aren't my responsibility.
Teft talked about the Radiance, about ideals and stories. Why couldn't men actually be like that? Why did they have to rely on dreams and fabrications for inspiration?
If you flee, you leave all the other bridgemen to be slaughtered, a voice whispered within him. There has to be something you can do for them.
No, he fought back. If I worry about that, I won't be able to save Bridge Four. If I find a way out, we're going.
If you leave, the voice seemed to say, then who will fight for them? Nobody cares. Nobody.
What was it his father had said all those years ago? He did what he felt was right because someone had to start. Someone had to take the first step. Kaladin's hand felt warm. He stopped in the chasm, closing his eyes. You couldn't feel any heat from a sphere, usually,
but the one in his hand seemed warm. And then, feeling completely natural about it, Kaladin breathed in deeply. The sphere grew cold, and a wave of heat shot up his arm. He opened his eyes. The sphere in his hand was done, and his fingers were crispy with frost. Light rose from him like smoke from a fire. White. Pure. He raised a hand and felt alive with energy. He had no need to breathe. In fact, he held the breath in, trapping the stormlight. Syl zipped back down the corridor toward him. She twisted around him, then came to rest in the air, taking the form of a woman.
You did it. What happened?
Kaladin shook his head, holding his breath. Something was surging within him, like a storm, raging inside his veins, a tempest sweeping about inside his chest cavity. It made him want to run, jump, yell. It almost made him want to burst. He felt as if he could walk on air, or walls. Yes, he thought. He broke into a run, leaping at the side of the chasm. He hit feet first, then bounced off and slammed back into the ground. He was so stunned that he cried out, and he felt the storm within him dampen as breath escaped. He lay on his back as stormlight rose from him more quickly now that he was breathing. He lay there as the last bit of it burned away. Syl landed on his chest.
Kaladin? What was that?
Me being an idiot, he replied, sitting up and feeling an ache in his back and a sharp pain in his elbow where he'd hit the ground. Teft said that the Radiants were able to walk on walls, and I felt so alive. Syl walked on air, stepping as if down a set of stairs.
I don't think you're ready for that yet. Don't be so risky. If you die, I go stupid again, you know.
I'll try to keep that in mind, Kaladin said, climbing to his feet. Maybe I'll remove dying from my list of tasks to do this week. She snorted, zipping into the air, becoming a ribbon again.
Come on, hurry up.
She shot off down the chasm. Kaladin collected the dun sphere, then dug into the pouch for another one to provide light. Had he drained them all? No. The others still glowed strongly. He selected a ruby mark, then hurried after Syl. She led him to a narrow chasm that contained a small group of fresh Parshendi corpses.
This is morbid, Kaladin,
Syl noted, standing above the bodies. I know. Do you know where Lopin went?
I sent him scavenging nearby, fetching the things you asked him for.
Bring him, please. Syl sighed, but zipped away. She always got testy when he made her appear to someone other than him. Kaladin knelt down. Parshendi all looked so similar. That same square face, those blocky, almost rock-like features. Some had the beards with bits of gemstone tied in them. Those glowed, but not brightly. Cut gemstones held stormlight better. Why was that? Rumors in camp claimed that the Parshendi took the wounded humans away and ate them. Rumors also said they left their dead, not caring for the fallen, never building them proper pyres. But that last part was false. They did care about their dead. They all seemed to have the same sensibility that Shen did. He threw a fit every time one of the bridgemen so much as touched a Parshendi corpse. I'd better be right about this, Kaladin thought grimly, slipping a knife off one of the Parshendi bodies. It was beautifully ornamented and forged, the steel lined with glyphs Kaladin didn't recognize. He began to cut at the strange breastplate armor that grew from the corpse's chest. Kaladin quickly determined that Parshendi physiology was very different from human physiology. Small blue ligaments held the breastplate to the skin underneath. It was attached all the way across. He continued working. There wasn't much blood. It had pooled at the corpse's back or leaked away. His knife wasn't a surgeon's tool, but it did the job just fine. By the time Syl returned with Lopin, Kaladin had gotten the breastplate free and had moved on to the carapace helm. It was harder to remove. It had grown into the skull in places,
and he had to saw with the serrated section of the blade.
"Oh, Goncho," Lopin said, a sack slung over his shoulder. "You don't like them at all, do you?"
Kaladin stood, wiping his hands on the Parshendi man's skirt. "Did you find what I asked for?"
"Sure did,"
Lopin said, letting down the sack and digging into it. He pulled out an armored leather vest and cap, the type that spearmen used. Then he took out some thin leather straps and a medium-sized wooden spearman's shield. Finally came a series of deep red bones. Parshendi bones. At the very bottom of the sack was the rope, the one Lopin had bought and tossed into the chasm, then stashed down below.
"You haven't lost your wits, have you?"
Lopin asked, eyeing the bones.
"Because if you have, I've got a cousin who makes this drink for people who've lost their wits, and it might make you better, sure."
"If I'd lost my wits," Kaladin said, walking over to a pool of still water to wash off the carapace helm, "would I say that I had?"
"Oh, no, no," Lopin said, leaning back. "Maybe. Guess it doesn't matter if you're crazy or not."
"You'd follow a crazy man into battle?"
"Sure," Lopin said. "If you're crazy, you're a good type, and I like you. Not a killing people in their sleep type of crazy."
He smiled.
"Besides, we all follow crazies all the time. Do it every day with light eyes."
Kaladin chuckled.
"So what's this all for?"
Kaladin didn't answer. He brought the breastplate over to the leather vest, then tied it onto the front with some of the leather straps. He did the same with the cap and the helm, though he eventually had to saw some grooves into the helm with his knife to make it stay. Once done, Kaladin used the last straps to tie the bones together and attach them to the front of the round wooden shield. The bones rattled as he lifted the shield, but he decided it was good enough. He took shield, cap, and breastplate and put them all into Lopin's sack. They barely fit. "All right," he said, standing up. "Syl, lead us to the short chasm." They'd spent some time investigating, finding the best place to launch arrows into the bottom of permanent bridges. One bridge in particular was close to Sadius's war camp, so they often traversed it on the way out on a bridge run and spanned a particularly shallow chasm, only about 40 feet deep, rather than the usual 100 or more. She nodded, then zipped away, leading them there. Kaladin and Lopin followed. Teft had orders to lead the others back and meet Kaladin at the base of the ladder, but Kaladin and Lopin should be far ahead of them. He spent the hike listening with half an ear as Lopin talked about his extended family. The more Kaladin thought about what he was planning, the more brazen it seemed. Perhaps Lopin was right to question his sanity. But Kaladin had tried being rational. He'd tried being careful. That had failed. Now there wasn't any more time for logic or care. Ashal obviously intended Bridge 4 to be exterminated. When clever, careful plans failed, it was time to try something desperate. Lopin cut off suddenly. Kaladin hesitated. The Herdazian man had grown pale-faced and frozen in place. What was... scraping? Kaladin froze as well, a panic rising in him. One of the side corridors echoed with a deep grinding sound. Kaladin turned slowly, just in time to catch sight of something large, no, something enormous, moving down the distant chasm. Shadows in the dim light, the sound of chitinous legs scratching on rock. Kaladin held his breath, sweating, but the beast didn't come in their direction. The scraping grew softer, then eventually faded. He and Lopin stood immobile for a long time after the last sound had vanished. Finally, Lopin spoke.
"Guess the nearby ones aren't all dead, eh, Goncho?"
"Yeah," Kaladin said. He jumped slightly as Syl zipped back to find them. He unconsciously sucked in stormlight as he did so, and when she alighted in the air, she found him sheepishly glowing.
"What is going on?"
she demanded, hands on hips. "Chasm fiend," Kaladin said.
"Really?"
She sounded excited.
"We could chase after it."
"What?"
"Sure," she said. "You could fight it, I'll bet."
"Syl." Her eyes were twinkling with amusement. "Just a joke."
"Come on."
She zipped away. He and Lopin stepped more softly now.
Eventually, Syl landed on the side of the chasm, standing there as if in mockery of when Kaladin had tried to walk up the wall. Kaladin looked up at the shadow of a wooden bridge 40 feet above. This was the shallowest chasm they'd been able to find. They tended to get deeper and deeper the farther eastward you went. More and more, he was certain that trying to escape to the east was impossible. It was too far, and surviving the high storm floods was too difficult a challenge. The original plan, fighting or bribing the guards, then running, was the best one. But they needed to live long enough to try that. The bridge above offered an opportunity, if Kaladin could reach it. He hefted his small bag of spheres and his slung sack full of armor and bones over his shoulder. He'd originally intended to have Rock shoot an arrow with a rope tied to it over the bridge, then back down into the chasm. With some men holding one end, another could have climbed up and tied the sack to the bridge's underside. But that would risk letting an arrow shoot out of the chasm where scouts could see. They were said to be very keen-eyed, as the armies depended on them to spot chasm fiends making chrysalises. Kaladin thought he had a better way than the arrow. Maybe. "We need rocks," he said. "Fist-size ones. A lot of them." Lopin shrugged and began searching about. Kaladin joined him, fishing them out of puddles and pulling them from crevasses. There was no shortage of stones in the chasms. In a short time, he had a large pile of rocks in a sack. He took the pouch of spheres in his hand and tried to think the same way he had earlier when he'd drawn in the stormlight. "This is our last chance." "Life before death," he whispered. "Strength before weakness. Journey before destination." The first ideal of the Night's Radiant. He breathed in deeply, and a thick jolt of power shot up his arm. His muscles burned with energy, with the desire to move. The tempest spread within, pushing at his skin, causing his blood to pump in a powerful rhythm. He opened his eyes. Glowing smoke rose around him. He was able to contain much of the light, holding it in by holding his breath. "It's like a storm inside me." It felt as if it would rip him apart. He set the sack with the armor on the ground, but wound the rope around his arm and tied the sack of rocks to his belt. He took out a single fist-sized stone and hefted it, feeling its storm-smoothed sides. "This had better work." He infused the stone with stormlight, frost crystallizing on his arm. He wasn't sure how he did it, but it felt natural, like pouring liquid into a cup. Light seemed to pool underneath the skin of his hand, then transfer to the rock, as if he were painting it with a vibrant, glowing liquid. He pressed the stone to the rock wall. It fixed in place, leaking stormlight, clinging so strongly that he couldn't pry it free. He tested his weight on it, and it held. He placed another one a little lower, then another a little higher. Then, wishing he had someone to burn him a prayer for success, he started climbing. He tried not to think about what he was doing. Climbing on rocks, stuck to the wall by... what? Light? Spren? He kept on going. It was a lot like climbing the stone formations back near Hearthstone with Tian, except that he could make handholds exactly where he wanted. "Should have found some rock dust to cover my hands," he thought, pulling himself up, then taking another stone from his sack and sticking it into place. Syl walked along beside him, her casual stroll seeming to mock the difficulty of his climb. As he shifted his weight to another rock, he heard an ominous click from below. He risked a glance downward. The first of his rocks had fallen free. The ones near it were leaking stormlight only faintly now. The rocks led up toward him like a set of burning footprints. The storm inside him had quieted, though it still blew and raged inside his veins, thrilling and distracting at the same time. What would happen if he ran out of light before he reached the top? The next rock fell free. The one beside it followed a few seconds later. Lopin stood on the other side of the chasm bottom, leaning against the wall, interested but relaxed. "Keep moving," Kaladin thought, annoyed at himself for getting distracted. he turned back to his work. Just as his arms were beginning to burn from the climb, he reached the underside of the bridge. He reached out as two more of his stones fell free. The clatter of each one was louder now, as they fell a much larger distance. Steadying himself on the bottom of the bridge with one hand, feet still pushing against the highest rocks, he looped the end of the rope around a wooden bridge support. He pulled it around and threaded it through again to make a makeshift knot. He left plenty of extra rope on the short end. He let the rest of the rope slide free of his shoulder and drop to the floor below.
"Lopin," he called.
Light steamed from his mouth as he spoke.
"Pull it tight."
The Herdazian did so, and Kaladin held to his end, making the knot firm. Then he took hold of the long section of rope and let himself swing free, dangling from the bottom of the bridge. The knot held. Kaladin relaxed. He was still steaming light, and, save for the call to Lopin, he'd been holding his breath for a good quarter hour. That could be handy, he thought, though his lungs were starting to burn, so he started to breathe normally. The light didn't leave him altogether, though it escaped faster.
All right, Kaladin said to Lopin. Tie the other sack to the bottom of the rope.
The rope wiggled, and a few moments later Lopin called up that it was done. Kaladin gripped the rope with his legs to hold himself in place, then used his hands to pull up the length underneath, hoisting up the sack full of armor. Using the rope on the short end of the knot, he slipped his pouch of dun spheres into the sack with the armor, then tied it into place underneath the bridge where, he hoped, Lopin and Dabbit would be able to get it from above. He looked down. The ground looked so much more distant than it would have from the bridge above. From this slightly different perspective, everything changed. He didn't get vertigo from the height. Instead, he felt a little surge of excitement. Something about him had always liked being up high. It felt natural. It was being below, trapped in holes and unable to see the world, that was depressing. He considered his next move.
What?
Syl asked, stepping up to him, standing on air. If I leave the rope here, someone might spot it while crossing the bridge.
So cut it free.
He looked at her, raising an eyebrow. While dangling from it?
You'll be fine.
That's a 40-foot drop. I'd break bones at the very least.
No,
Syl said.
I feel right about this, Kaladin. You'll be fine. Trust me.
Trust you. Syl, you've said yourself that your memory is fractured.
You insulted me the other week, she said, folding her arms. I think you owe me an apology.
I'm supposed to apologize by cutting a rope and dropping 40 feet?
No, you apologize by trusting me. I told you. I feel right about this.
He sighed, looking down again. His stormlight was running out. What else could he do? Leaving the rope would be foolish. Could he tie it in another knot? One he could shake free once at the bottom? If that type of knot existed, he didn't know how to tie it. He clenched his teeth. Then, as the last of his rocks fell off and clattered to the ground, he took a deep breath and pulled out the Parshendi knife he'd taken earlier. He moved swiftly before he had a chance to reconsider and sliced the rope free. He dropped in a rush, one hand still holding the sliced rope, stomach lurching with the jarring distress of falling. The bridge shot away as if rising, and Kaladin's panicked mind immediately sent his eyes downward. This wasn't beautiful. This was terrifying. It was horrible. He was going to die.
It's all right.
His emotions calmed in a heartbeat. Somehow he knew what to do. He twisted in the air, dropping the rope and hitting the ground with both feet down. He came to a crouch, resting one hand on the stone, a jolt of coldness shooting through him. His remaining stormlight came out in a single burst, flung from his body in a luminescent smoke ring that crashed against the ground before spreading out, vanishing. He stood up straight. Lopin gaped. Kaladin felt an ache in his legs from hitting, but it was like that of having leaped 4 or 5 feet.
Like 10 crashes of thunder on the mounts, gon'cha?
Lopin exclaimed.
That was incredible.
Thank you, Kaladin said. He raised a hand to his head, glancing at the rocks scattered above the base of the wall, then looking up at the armor tied securely up above.
I told you,
she said, landing on his shoulder. She sounded triumphant. Lopin, Kaladin said. You think you can get that bundle of armor during the next bridge run?
Sure, Lopin said. Nobody will see. They ignore us, Hurties. They ignore bridgemen, and they especially ignore cripples. To them, I'm so invisible I should be walking through walls.
Kaladin nodded. Get it. Hide it. Give it to me right before the final plateau assault.
They aren't gonna like you going into a bridge run armored, Goncho, Lopin said. I don't think this will be any different from what you tried before.
We'll see, Kaladin said. Just do it. Sixty. That which we cannot have. The death is my life. The strength becomes my weakness. The journey has ended. Dated Beta Bannis, 1173. 95 seconds pre-death. Subject a scholar of some minor renown. Sample collected second-hand. Considered questionable.
That is why, Father, Adolin said, you absolutely cannot abdicate to me no matter what we discover with the visions.
Is that so? Dalinar asked, smiling to himself.
Yes.
Very well. You've convinced me. Adolin stopped dead in the hallway. The two of them were on their way to Dalinar's chambers. Dalinar turned and looked back at the younger man.
Really? Adolin asked. I mean, I actually won an argument with you?
Yes, Dalinar said. Your points are valid. He didn't add that he'd come to the decision on his own. No matter what, I will stay. I can't leave this fight now. Adolin smiled broadly. But, Dalinar said, raising a finger, I have a requirement. I will draft an order, notarized by the highest of my scribes and witnessed by Elokar, that gives you the right to depose me should I grow too mentally unstable. We won't let the other camps know of it, but I will not risk letting myself get so crazy that it's impossible to remove me.
All right, Adolin said, walking up to Dalinar.
They were alone in the hallway. I can accept that. Assuming you don't tell Sadius about it. I still don't trust him. I'm not asking you to trust him, Dalinar said, pushing the door open to his chambers. You just need to believe that he is capable of changing. Sadius was once a friend, and I think he can be again. The cool stones of the Soulcast chamber seemed to hold the chill of the spring weather. It continued to refuse to slip into summer, but at least it hadn't slid into winter, either. Elthabar promised that it would not do so, but then the Storm Warden's promises were always filled with caveats. The Almighty's will was mysterious, and the signs couldn't always be trusted. He accepted Storm Wardens now, though when they'd first grown popular, he'd rejected their aid. No man should try to know the future, nor lay claim to it, for it belonged only to the Almighty himself, and Dalinar wondered how Storm Wardens could do their research without reading. They claimed they didn't, but he'd seen their books filled with glyphs. Glyphs. They weren't meant to be used in books, they were pictures. A man who had never seen one before could still understand what one meant, based on its shape. That made interpreting glyphs different from reading. Storm Wardens did a lot of things that made people uncomfortable. Unfortunately, they were just so useful. Knowing when a high storm might strike, well, that was just too tempting an advantage. Even though Storm Wardens were frequently wrong, they were more often right. Renara knelt beside the hearth, inspecting the fabrial that had been installed there to warm the room. Navani had already arrived. She sat at Dalinar's elevated writing desk, scribbling a letter. She waved a distracted greeting with her reed as Dalinar entered.
She wore the fabrial he had seen her displaying at the feast a few weeks back. The multi-legged contraption was attached to her shoulder, gripping the cloth of her violet dress. "I don't know, Father," Adolin said, closing the door. Apparently he was still thinking about Sadius. "I don't care if he's listening to the Way of Kings. He's just doing it to make you look less closely at the plateau assaults so that his clerks can arrange his cut of the gem hearts more favorably. He's manipulating you." Dalinar shrugged. "Gem hearts are secondary, son. If I can reforge an alliance with him, then it's worth nearly any cost. In a way, I'm the one manipulating him." Adolin sighed. "Very well. But I'm still going to keep a hand on my money pouch when he's near." "Just try not to insult him," Dalinar said. "Oh, and something else. I would like you to take extra care with the King's Guard. If there are soldiers we know for certain are loyal to me, put those in charge of guarding Elokar's rooms. His words about a conspiracy have me worried."
"Surely you don't give them credence," Adolin said.
"Something odd did happen with his armor. This whole mess stinks like creme slime. Perhaps it will turn out to be nothing. For now, humor me."
"I have to note," Navani said, "that I didn't much care for Sadius back when you, he, and Gavilar were friends."
She finished her letter with a flourish.
"He's not behind the attacks on the king," Dalinar said.
"How can you be certain?"
Navani asked.
"Because it's not his way," Dalinar said. "Sadius never wanted the title of king. Being High Prince gives him plenty of power, but leaves him with someone to take the blame for large-scale mistakes."
Dalinar shook his head.
"He never tried to seize the throne from Gavilar, and he's even better positioned with Elokar."
"Because my son's a weakling," Navani said.
It wasn't an accusation.
"He's not weak," Dalinar said. "He's inexperienced. But yes, that does make the situation ideal for Sadius. He's telling the truth. He asked to be High Prince of Information because he wants very badly to find out who is trying to kill Elokar."
"Mashallah,"
Renarin said, using the formal term for aunt.
"That fabrial on your shoulder, what does it do?"
Navani looked down at the device with a sly smile. Dalinar could see she'd been hoping one of them would ask. Dalinar sat down. The high storm would be coming soon.
"Oh, this? It's a typical pain reel. Here, let me show you."
She reached up with her safe hand, pushing a clip that released the claw-like legs. She held it up.
"Do you have any aches, dear? A stubbed toe, perhaps, or a scrape?"
Renarin shook his head.
"I pulled a muscle in my hand during dueling practice earlier," Adolin said. "It's not bad, but it does ache."
"Come over here," Navani said.
Dalinar smiled fondly. Navani was always at her most genuine when playing with new fabrials. It was one of the few times when one got to see her without any pretense. This wasn't Navani the king's mother or Navani the political schemer. This was Navani the excited engineer.
"The Artifabrian community is doing some amazing things," Navani said as Adolin proffered his hand. "I'm particularly proud of this little device, as I had a hand in its construction."
She clipped it onto Adolin's hand, wrapping the claw-like legs around the palm and locking them into place. Adolin raised his hand, turning it around.
"The pain is gone."
"But you can still feel, correct?"
Navani said in a self-satisfied way. Adolin prodded his palm with the fingers of his other hand.
"The hand isn't numb at all."
Renarin watched with keen interest, bespectacled eyes curious, intense. If only the lad could be persuaded to become an ardent. He could be an engineer then if he wanted. And yet he refused. His reasons always seemed like poor excuses to Dalinar.
"It's kind of bulky," Dalinar noted.
"Well, it's just an early model,"
Navani said defensively.
"I was working backward from one of those dreadful creations of long shadows, and I didn't have the luxury of refining the shape.
I think it has a lot of potential. Imagine a few of these on a battlefield to dull the pain of wounded soldiers. Imagine it in the hands of a surgeon who wouldn't have to worry about his patient's pain while working on them.
Adolin nodded. Dalinar had to admit it did sound like a useful device. Navani smiled.
This is a special time to be alive. We're learning all kinds of things about fabrials. This, for instance, is a diminishing fabrial. It decreases something, in this case pain. It doesn't actually make the wound any better, but it might be a step in that direction. Either way, it's a completely different type from paired fabrials like the span reeds. If you could see the plans we have for the future.
Like what? Adolin asked.
You'll find out eventually, Navani said, smiling mysteriously.
She removed the fabrial from Adolin's hand.
Shard blades? Adolin sounded excited. Well, no, Navani said. The design and workings of shard blades and plate are completely different from everything we've discovered. The closest anyone has are those shields in Yakaved. But as far as I can tell, they use a completely different design principle from regular shard plate. The ancients must have had a wondrous grasp of engineering.
No, Dalinar said. I've seen them, Navani. They're ancient. Their technology is primitive.
And the Dawn Cities? Navani asked skeptically. The Fabrials?
Dalinar shook his head. I've seen neither. There are shard blades in the visions, but they seem so out of place. Perhaps they were given directly by the heralds, as the legends say.
Perhaps, Navani said. Why don't...
She vanished. Dalinar blinked. He hadn't heard the high storm approaching. He was now in a large, open room with pillars running along the sides. The enormous pillars looked sculpted of soft sandstone, with unornamented, granular sides. The ceiling was far above, carved from the rock and geometric patterns that looked faintly familiar. Circles connected by lines, spreading outward from one another.
I don't know what to do, old friend, a voice said from the side.
Dalinar turned to see a youthful man in regal white and gold robes walking with his hands clasped before him, hidden by voluminous sleeves. He had dark hair pulled back in a braid, and a short beard that came to a point. Gold threads were woven into his hair and came together on his forehead to form a golden symbol, the symbol of the Knight's Radiant.
They say that each time it is the same, the man said. We are never ready for desolations. We should be getting better at resisting, but each time we step closer to destruction instead.
He turned to Dalinar as if expecting a response. Dalinar glanced down. He too wore ornamental robes, though not as lavish. Where was he? What time? He needed to find clues for Navani to record, and for Yasna to use in proving or disproving these dreams.
I don't know what to say either, Dalinar responded.
If he wanted information, he needed to act more natural than he had in previous visions. The regal man sighed.
I had hoped you would have wisdom to share with me, Karm.
They continued walking toward the side of the room, approaching a place where the wall split into a massive balcony with a stone railing. It looked out upon an evening sky. The setting sun stained the air a dirty, sultry red.
Our own natures destroy us, the regal man said, voice soft, though his face was angry. Alakavish was a surge binder. He should have known better. And yet the Nile bond gave him no more wisdom than a regular man. Alas, not all Spren are as discerning as Honor Spren.
I agree, Dalinar said.
The other man looked relieved.
I worried that you would find my claims too forward. Your own surge binders were... But no, we should not look backward.
What's a surge binder? Dalinar wanted to scream the question out, but there was no way. not without sounding completely out of place.
Perhaps.
What do you think should be done with these surge binders? Dalinar asked carefully.
I don't know if we can force them to do anything.
Their footsteps echoed in the empty room. Were there no guards, no attendants?
Their power... Well, Alakavish proves the allure that surge binders have for the common people. If only there was a way to encourage them.
The man stopped, turning to Dalinar.
They need to be better, old friend.
We all do. The responsibility of what we've been given, whether it be the crown or the Nile bond, needs to make us better. He seemed to expect something from Dalinar, but what?
I can read your disagreement in your face, the regal man said. It's all right, Karm. I realize that my thoughts on this subject are unconventional. Perhaps the rest of you are right. Perhaps our abilities are proof of a divine mantle. But if this is true, should we not be more wary of how we act?
Dalinar frowned. That sounded familiar to him. The regal man sighed, walking to the balcony lip. Dalinar joined him, stepping outside. The perspective finally allowed him to look down at the landscape below. Thousands of corpses confronted him. Dalinar gasped. Dead filled the streets of the city outside, a city that Dalinar vaguely recognized.
Kolinar, he thought. My homeland.
He stood with the regal man at the top of a low tower, three stories high, a keep of some sort, constructed of stone. It seemed to sit where the palace would someday be. The city was unmistakable, with its peaked stone formations rising like enormous fins into the air. The wind blades, they were called. But they were less weathered than he was accustomed to, and the city around them was very different. Built of blocky stone structures, many of which had been knocked down. The destruction spread far, lining the sides of primitive streets. Had the city been hit by an earthquake? No. Those corpses had fallen in battle. Dalinar could smell the stench of blood, viscera, smoke. The bodies lay strewn about, many near the low wall that surrounded the keep. The wall was broken in places, smashed, and there were rocks of strange shape mixed about the corpses. Stones cut like...
Blood of my fathers,
Dalinar thought, gripping the stone railing, leaning forward.
Those aren't stones. They're creatures.
Massive creatures, easily 5 or 6 times the size of a person, their skin dull and gray like granite. They had long limbs and skeletal bodies, the forelegs, or were they arms, set into wide shoulders. The faces were lean, narrow, arrow-like.
What happened here?
Dalinar asked, despite himself.
It's terrible. I ask myself this same thing. How could we let this occur? The desolations are well named. I've heard initial counts. 11 years of war and 9 out of 10 people I once ruled are dead. Do we even have kingdoms to lead any longer? Sur is gone, I'm sure of it.
Tarma, Ilis, they won't likely survive. Too many of their people have fallen. Dalinar had never heard of those places. The man made a fist, pounding it softly against the railing. Burning stations had been set up in the distance. They had begun cremating the corpses.
The others want to blame Alakavish. And true, if he hadn't brought us to war before the desolation, we might not have been broken this badly. But Alakavish was a symptom of a greater disease. When the heralds next return, what will they find? A people who have forgotten them yet again? A world torn by war and squabbling? If we continue as we have, then perhaps we deserve to lose.
Dalinar felt a chill. He had thought that this vision must come after his previous one. but prior visions hadn't been chronological. He hadn't seen any Knights Radiant yet, but that might not be because they had disbanded. Perhaps they didn't exist yet. And perhaps there was a reason this man's words sounded so familiar. Could it be? Could he really be standing beside the very man whose words Dalinar had listened to time and time again? There is honor in loss, Dalinar said carefully, using words repeated several times in the way of kings. If that loss brings learning, the man smiled. Using my own sayings against me again, Karm? Dalinar felt himself grow short of breath. The man himself. Noadan. The great king. He was real. Or he had been real. This man was younger than Dalinar had imagined him, but that humble yet regal bearing. Yes. It was right. I'm thinking of giving up my throne, Noadan said softly. No, Dalinar stepped toward him. You mustn't. I cannot lead them, the man said. Not if this is what my leadership brings them to. Noadan, the man turned to him, frowning. What? Dalinar paused. Could he be wrong about this man's identity? But no. The name Noadan was more of a title. Many famous people in history had been given holy names by the church before it was disbanded. Even Bajerdin wasn't likely to be his real name. That was lost in time. It is nothing, Dalinar said. You cannot give up your throne. The people need a leader. They have leaders, Noadan said. There are princes, kings, soul-casters, surge-binders. We never lack men and women who wish to lead.